Well, when you hear those trombones play, it means it's time to recognize birthdays for our listeners. Unfortunately for today, we have no one on our list. So we'll just kind of move on and go to the celebrity birthdays and see who's having celebrations today. Actor-singer Anne Margaret turns 83. TV host-comedian Jay Leno is 74. Actor Mary McDonnell is 72. Singer-bassist Kim Corden of Sonic Youth is 71. Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan, 64. Rapper Too Short is 58. Actor Bridget Moynihan is 53. Actor George Garcia is 51. Actor Elizabeth Rome is 51. Actor Penelope Cruz is 50. Actor and entrepreneur Jessica Alba is 43. And actor Harry Shum Jr. is 42. And then finally, actor Jenna Uskovich is 38. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you are hearing us on your television on Iowa PBS and you are not a registered IRIS listener, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so we can get you on our list. We need to know who is listening in order to keep our services free. And also remember to give us a call again at that number, 515-243-6833, if you want you or someone that you know on our birthday list. And now we'll turn to Lisa to get us started on obituaries.
Dr. Alan Annenberg, MD, from Carroll. Dr. Alan Dolliver Annenberg, age 93, passed away on Saturday, April 20th at Acura Healthcare in Carroll. Funeral services will be held on Friday, May 3rd at 11 a.m. at the United Methodist Church in Carroll. Burial will be in the Carroll City Cemetery with full military honors by the Carroll American Legion. Visitation will be held Friday morning, May 3rd from 9:30 a.m. until 10:45 a.m. at the United Methodist Church in Carroll. Funeral arrangements are under the direction of the Don and Woodhouse Funeral Home in Carroll. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.donandwoodhouse.com. Betty Lindman of Bondurant. Betty Lindman, 92, passed away April 19th. She was born December 13th, 1931, in Kennings, Kansas. Betty's wishes were to be cremated with no services, condolences, and to read the full obituary, please visit www.hamiltonsfuneralhome.com. Douglas Balsam of Urbandale. Celebration of life services for Douglas Balsam, 83, who passed away Sunday, April 21st in Urbandale, will be held at 10 a.m. Friday, May 3rd at the Scotch Ridge Presbyterian Church. Interment of cremains will follow services in the Scotch Ridge Cemetery. The family will greet friends 1 hour prior to services Friday at the church. For a complete obituary, visit our website at www.overtonfunerals.com. Jean Galvin of Des Moines. Jean Lois Smith Galvin passed away peacefully on April 20th at age 97. A private family service will be held. A full obituary may be found at www.cremationiowa.com. Darby Madison of Des Moines. Darby Madison, age 81, passed away April 22nd. She was born October 3rd, 1942, in Bismarck, North Dakota. Condolences and to read her full obituary, please visit www.hamiltonsfuneralhome.com. Willard Will Ray of West Des Moines, remembered by his always ready smile and hard work, passion, great capacity to love and laugh, Willard Will Ray passed away April 18th. Will joins those in heaven, including many family members. And to read his full obituary, go to www.hamiltonsfuneralhome.com. Ann Boltinghouse of Ankeny. Ann Olson Boltinghouse passed away on April 24th. She was born May 14th, 1939 in Elkader to Avron and Avalon Olson. A memorial service will be held at 3 p.m. on Tuesday, April 30th at Memorial Services of Iowa in Ankeny. The service will be live streamed at vimeo.com/event/426-0846. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made in Ann's name to the Animal Rescue League in Des Moines. To read her full obituary, please go to www.memorialservicesofiowa.com. Myrnie F. Friedley of Des Moines. Myrna Florence Friedley, daughter of Earl and Pearl Blanchfield, was born on December 31st, 1929, in the small town of Lytton. She passed away peacefully with her children by her side on April 19th. She was 94 years old. A celebration of Myrna's life will take place on Tuesday, May 7th at 11 a.m. at the McLaren's Chapel in West Des Moines. Visitation will also take place at 10 a.m. The celebration will also include Robert's life, as the COVID pandemic prevented a celebration of his life from taking place. Burial will follow directly at Rest Haven Cemetery. Memorial contributions may be made to the Variety Club of Iowa or St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital. Joseph Caligiuri of Norwalk. Joseph Charles Caligiuri, age 76, passed away peacefully on Thursday, April 25th, surrounded by his family. Joe was born in Des Moines on June 18th to Ila and Dominic Caligiuri. Joe grew up on the south side of Des Moines and graduated from Dowling Catholic High School in 1965. Upon graduation, Joe attended Drake University, at which time he decided to pursue his passion for golf. This passion began at the young age of 10, caddying at Wakanda Club. His dedication and the expertise of the sport led him to the role of superintendent at Echo Valley Country Club, where he left an indelible mark on the course and the community alike. In Joe's retirement years, he was a tax preparer and maintenance man for apartment complexes. In every job he had, he enjoyed helping others. Joe also served honorably in the United States Army alongside his twin brother, Jim. He dedicated himself to the service of his nation during the Vietnam War from January 20th, 1969 to September 16th, 1970. Joe was a man whose life was deeply rooted in family values and hard work. Born into a bustling household with six siblings, he learned the importance of dedication and the bond of love and hard work from an early age. Growing up in a dynamic environment, Joe developed a strong sense of responsibility toward his family, a trait that would be passed on to his children. Joe's love of sports was evident in every aspect of his life, whether it was cheering from the sidelines as his children participated in various sports or passionately rooting for his beloved teams. He was a devoted fan of the Boston Celtics, the Iowa State Cyclones, Chicago Bears, Chicago Cubs, finding joy in every victory and resilience in every defeat. As the years passed, Joe's love of sports only deepened, especially as he proudly embraced the role of Papa Jojo. It gave him great joy to cheer on his grandchildren at their t-ball games or watching their excitement as they opened ball cards that he had gifted them. Visitation will be held on Tuesday, April 30th from 4 to 7 p.m. with a rosary service at 6:30 p.m. at Sunset Memorial Chapel on Fleur Drive in Des Moines. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, May 1st at Christ the King Catholic Church. Memorials may be directed to the family. Robert Allen Munford of Madrid. Robert Bob Allen Munford entered eternal life on April 19th. Robert was born on September 19th, 1948 in Oklahoma City to Thomas T. Munford Sr. and Ellen Munford Eads. His big brother Tommy Jr. awaited his arrival as well, and the family moved to LaGrange, Illinois, and then eventually to Des Moines. He attended Roosevelt High School, where he met one of his first loves, Stephanie Messenger, at age 16. Bob and Taffy, as she was called, had a baby boy, Chuck, and the family decided it was best to give up for adoption. Bob went on to graduate from high school and attend Drake University with the Sigma Alpha Epsilon fraternity. He also served a brief time in the Air Force, where he furthered his knowledge of electronics. After his years of schooling, Bob had a group of friends that he liked to travel down to Mexico and Central America with. He loved the culture there and went back many times. While hanging out with these friends, he met the love of his life, Terry Sly. Bob and Terry went on to have 3 children of their own, Matthew, Noah, and Michaela. They eventually made a life in Madrid, where they resided for many years. The son, Bob, at 16, Chuck Jones, also reunited with him and always kept a wonderful relationship with the family. Bob and Terry raised their children and worked hard to create a memorial childhood for them, a memorable childhood. He strived to be a hardworking role model for his children to look up to. He worked for AMSCO, Steris Corporation, as a service technician on sterilizers for more than 20 years when he retired in 2015. Bob fearlessly battled prostate cancer and then after retirement, lung cancer. During these challenging times, he accepted Jesus into his heart and became best friends with his mother-in-law, Jean Sly. He loved to spend Sundays going to church with her and bringing delicious food for everyone to enjoy afterwards. He was blessed with many grandchildren during these times and recently a great-grandson. He had the pleasure of living with his daughter, son-in-law, and 2 of his grandchildren, which always drove him to get through all the obstacles that life threw at him. His calm demeanor, always pleasant attitude, and caring heart made Bob easy to enjoy time with. Bob always made you feel in his welcome, in his presence, no matter who you were. A celebration of life will be scheduled at a future time, and we hope everyone comes to share the wonderful memories that Bob left you all with.
Thomas Charles Goldman of Des Moines passed away peacefully on Monday, April 22nd, surrounded by his beloved family. He was 77 years old, born in Des Moines, Iowa, to Harold and Kate Goldman in 1946. Tom's life was marked by relentless pursuit of adventure and a steadfast commitment to his community. He graduated from Roosevelt High School in 1964 and went on to earn his degree from the University of Iowa in 1969. In lieu of flowers, the family asked that you please make donations to the Kate Goldman Children's Theater. The Association for the Preservation of Clear Lake, Iowa, or a charitable organization of the donor's preference. There will be a small private family service held in honor of Thomas Charles Goldman. Nona Frances Johnson, age 92, passed away on April 19th. A visitation will be held on Saturday, May 4th, at Ankeny Christian Church, Ankeny, Iowa, in the Des Moines area, from 10 to 11 a.m. A service will follow the visitation. Burial will take place at the Iowa Masonic Cemetery in Des Moines. Ling Blomston Care Center holds a quarterly memorial service for residents who have recently passed. Francis will be included in the service being held at their chapel at 1415 Almond Avenue, St. Paul, Minnesota, on May 16th at 4 p.m. In lieu of flowers, Francis's family suggests memorial contributions for the Ankeny Christian Church, the Alzheimer's Association, and I guess that's what we have for Nona Johnson. Chandler Harbers Bowerman. Chandler Harbers Bowerman was born in Des Moines on August 9th of 1976. He passed away peacefully at home on April 6th of 2024. The cause of death was a dissection of an aortic aneurysm. Chandler grew up in Des Moines and attended Edmonds Academy of Fine Arts Middle School and Roosevelt High School. During his formative years, he traveled to Germany, Australia, and Japan and attended Space Camp, Violin Camp, Billy Taylor Jazz Camp, and Birch Creek Music Performance Camp. Music and baseball were two huge influences in Chandler Harbers Bowerman's life. Memorial gifts may be sent to the Chandler Harbers Bowerman Memorial Scholarship Fund in care of the NIU Foundation, P.O. Box 746, DeKalb, Illinois. Gifts can also be made online by visiting foundation.myniu.com. When making a gift online, please select Donation Other in the designation search box and include the name of Mr. Bowerman. Anthony Dominic Farrow. Mr. Farrow's last name is F-A-R-A-O. He was born July 10th, 1946 in Des Moines. He was preceded in death by his parents, Anna Rose and Frank, and brother Frank Jr. He is survived by his wife, Veronica, sister Annette Bear, sons Gabriel and Michael, daughters Rachel Lynch and Lauren Monticelli, grandchildren Libby, Abby, Ava, Dominic, Antonio, and Giovanna. He graduated from Dowling High School in 1964. He loved cooking, hiking, jogging, visiting Lake Tahoe, spending time with family and friends. And he was an active member in his church, making others laugh, but most of all, he loved the Lord. There is no indication in this obituary about services. Esther Brisseno, and Esther's last name is spelled B-R-I-S-E-N-O. She was age 93. She passed away on April 21st at Wesley-on-Grand. She was born in 1930 in Colfax County, New Mexico, to Jose Samuel and Emma F. Tafoya. And Esther worked for Highland Potato Chip Company, Bishop's Cafeteria, and Hy-Vee on Fleur. She was a member of the American Legion Auxiliary Hispanic Unit, 731. She was elected treasurer. She was a long-standing member of the Christ the King Catholic Church. She was a breast cancer survivor in 1985. Funeral service with Mass is scheduled for May 3rd, 2024 at 11 a.m. at Christ the King. The visitation will be the night before on May 2nd at Sunset Memorial Garden from 5 to 7. A burial will take place after the Mass on May 3rd at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Rita Mae Walters, age 94, passed away on April 24th. She was born in December of 1929 in Villisca, Iowa. She graduated from Villisca High School in 47. She lived in Red Oak, Iowa, working at two banks. In 53, she went to work for the city of Red Oak, eventually promoted to the position of city clerk. In 1960, she moved to West Des Moines with her two children and worked at Conditioned Air Corporation for 9 years. In 1969, she went to work for Pete Marvick, CPAs, until her retirement in 92. According to her wishes, there will be no funeral. The family will gather in her memory at a later date. Nancy W., and I'm going to spell the last name here. It's E-O-R-I-A-T-T-I. And Nancy was age 96. She was living in Moserly, Virginia, and formerly of Grand Island, Nebraska, and then also Des Moines, Iowa. She died on January 18th of 2024. Funeral services will be held at Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church in Grand Island on Tuesday, May 7th at 11 a.m. An additional service will be held at St. Teresa Catholic Church in Des Moines, Iowa on Friday, May 10th at 10:30 a.m., followed by interment in Glendale Cemetery. Memorials are suggested to Blessed Sacrament Church, the Ladies Auxiliary of the Military Order of the Purple Heart, and the Patriotic Order of Doe's. Barbara Griffin, Barb Marie Griffin, Cunningham Griffin, passed away peacefully after a battle with cancer on April 16th. She was born in 51 to Veronica and William Ray Cunningham. She grew up on a farm near Cumming, Iowa, and had a wonderful childhood. She lived most of her life in central Iowa. Between 1973 and 79, she worked as a computer programmer, analyst, and supervisor. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. with a prayer service at 6:30 p.m. on Friday, May 3rd at Hamilton's on Westtown Parkway, and that's at 3601 Westtown Parkway, West Des Moines, Iowa, and the Mass of Christian Burial at 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, May 4th, 2024 at St. Teresa Catholic Church on Merle Hay Road. Memorial donations may be made to St. Teresa Catholic Church in Des Moines, and condolences expressed at HamiltonFuneralHome.com. Josetta Mulville Hill, and that's spelled Mulvihill, age 81, of Cumming, Iowa, passed away on April 22nd. She was a beloved mother and friend who will be deeply missed by all who knew her. Visitation will be held from 3 to 6 p.m. Sunday, April 28th, at Caldwell Parish Funeral Home in Urbandale, with a rosary taking place at 5:30 p.m. Mass of Christian Burial will take place at 10 a.m. Monday, April 29th, at St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Cumming, with burial to follow. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions can be donated to St. Patrick's Catholic Church and or to Ruth Harbor Ministries, a ministry for unwed mothers. A live stream of the funeral will be available at CaldwellParish.com. Jack Brunoit, and Jack's last name, B-R-U-N-O-T-T-E, of Clive, Iowa, age 78, passed away peacefully on April 22nd. He was born in October of 1945. He graduated from Mitchellville High School and the American Institute of Business. He served in the U.S. Army. He retired from the Des Moines Police Force after 29 years of dedicated service. Family will greet guests on Friday, May 3rd, from 10 a.m. to 12 at Hamilton's Mitchellville Funeral Home, and that's on 303 Carter Avenue in Mitchellville. Following visitations, a funeral service will be held at the funeral home at 12 p.m. Burial will take place at the Mitchellville Cemetery in Mitchellville. Memorial contributions may be directed to his family or the Des Moines Police Department. That address, 25 East 1st Street in Des Moines. When making your donation, please direct it to the K-9 Department in memory of Jack. Other condolences may be expressed at HamiltonsFuneralHome.com. Sandra Sue Sapp passed away peacefully in Norwalk on April 21st. Sandy, as she was known to her friends and family, was born in 1942 in Des Moines. She attended school in Des Moines, graduating from East High School in 1960. She worked for many years at Iowa Pool and Plumbing and Mid-American Energy. A visitation will be held on Tuesday, April 3rd, from 10 to 11 a.m. at Lutheran Church of Hope at 925 Jordan Creek Parkway, West Des Moines, Iowa, followed by a memorial service at 11 a.m. You may offer condolences at islescare.com. And I think we have one more obituary before I turn it back over to Lisa. John J. Chavez, Jr., age 84, died on April 23rd. The family will receive condolences on Sunday, April 28th, that would be today, at Isles Dunn's Chapel beginning at 1 p.m. A funeral service will be held at 2 p.m., followed by a graveside service and interment at Jewish Glendale Cemetery. And John was a lifelong member of both Temple B'nai Jeshurun and Tilarif Israel Synagogue, as well as serving on the board of Calvin Manor.
Understanding Earth's Plant Blossoms. We have one final news article here in the USA Today Network's World and Nation Extra. This is the Genome Study Details Evolution of Angiosperms. And this is written by Will Dunham. Dateline Washington, flowering plants from corn, wheat, rice, and potatoes to maple, oak, apple, and cherry trees, as well as roses, tulips, daisies, and dandelions, and even the corpse flower and the voodoo lily are cornerstones of Earth's ecosystems and essential for humankind. New research based on genome data for 9,506 species, as well as an examination of 200 fossils, provides the deepest understanding to date of the evolutionary history of flowering plants called angiosperms, the largest and most diverse plant group. It detailed how angiosperms appeared and became dominant during the age of dinosaurs and how they changed over time. The scientists devised a new tree of life for angiosperms, covering 15 times more types of flowering plants, nearly 60% of them, than the nearest comparable study. It is a massive leap forward in our understanding of plant evolution, said botanist William Baker of the Royal Botanical Gardens, Kew, in London, senior author of the research published on Wednesday in the journal Nature. Angiosperms, plants that produce flowers and generate their seeds and fruits, encompass about 330,000 species and comprise about 80% of the world's plants. They include, among others, all the major food crops, grasses, most broadleaf trees, and most aquatic plants. Their closest relatives are the gymnosperms, a group that preceded them on Earth and includes conifers and some others with a bit more than 1,000 species. The study identified two pulses of diversification among angiosperms. The first one occurred around 150 million years ago at the dawn of their existence during the Mesozoic era, with 80% of major angiosperm lineages arising during that time. The next one happened about 100 million years ago during the Cenozoic era, after the demise of the dinosaurs and the rise of mammals, and amid decreasing global temperatures. Angiosperms have many structural adaptations that confer advantages over gymnosperms, but chief among these are those contributing to the reproductive process, Baker said. Gymnosperms and angiosperms both have seeds, but the flowering plants that enclosed seeds that protect them from dehydration and enable them to prosper in a wider range of environments, which would be the angiosperms, from tropics to deserts to Antarctica. They also evolved the flower, a structure that allowed them to form relationships with animal pollinators, especially insects, while gymnosperms usually rely upon the wind for pollination. Angiosperms evolved a high diversity of fruit types, permitting effective seed dispersal. With these innovations, angiosperms became invincible, Baker said. Charles Darwin, the 19th century British naturalist and architect of evolutionary theory, was astonished by how flowering plants exploded onto the scene in the Mesozoic fossil record. In an 1879 letter to Joseph Hooker, Kew's then director, Darwin wrote that the rapid development, as far as we can judge, of all the higher plants within recent geological times is an abominable mystery. Remarkably, Baker said, we have been able to use the molecular fossil record, the accumulated change in DNA over time, to see real evidence of that explosion happening at the dawn of the angiosperms. Flowering plants provide the majority of calories consumed by humans, grains, fruits, and vegetables, including indirectly as feed for livestock. They also have enthralled people with their beauty, fields of sunflowers, bouquets of roses, bunches of calla lilies, and their pleasant fragrance. They are sources of many of our medicines and hold potential solutions to global challenges such as climate change, biodiversity loss, human health, food security, and renewable energy, Baker said. The study could help scientists better understand disease and pest resistance in angiosperms and navigate potential new medicinal uses, for example, to combat malaria. Combining the tree of life with the extinction risk assessments for each lineage allows us to prioritize lineages for conservation based on their uniqueness, Kew botanist and lead study author Alexander Zantini said. This is extremely important for mankind, as these lineages may hold chemical compounds or even genes that can be useful for the survival of our species.
For the past 90 minutes, your readers have been Lisa Horsch and I'm Dave Stutz. It's been our pleasure to read for you. Thank you for listening. Now we'll take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place.
Welcome back. Your new readers are Bobby Bailey and Nicholas Herder. We'll continue with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Here's Bobby with our next article.
And good morning to everyone. It is Sunday, so we have a big chunk of opinion section op-ed things to share with you. Not that we'll do it all, but at least we'll kick off this part of the shift with that. And the first one is the Register's editorial. The headline says, Governor Kim Reynolds' handpicked legislature steamrolls extreme path for Iowa. The eight-year period since Republicans cemented control of Iowa's executive and legislative branches is an often used and useful shorthand for gauging how the state has changed. But the two-year General Assembly that just wrapped up is at least as useful a measuring stick. It's the first iteration of the legislature that was literally shaped by Governor Kim Reynolds and her worldview, and she used her influence to change the state in ways that will be difficult to reverse. Iowans should take up that challenge, though, and begin to pull the state back from the extremist pivot on display the past 2 years. How we got here. Reynolds helped oust incumbents who stalled her private school plan. The GOP has forcefully exerted its will, to be sure, since the first weeks of 2017, when lawmakers and Governor Terry Branstad gutted public union bargaining rights. But in 2022, after Reynolds' proposal for scholarships to bring public school funding to private schools fizzled, the governor raised the demand for fealty to new heights by campaigning against incumbent Republicans who she knew had opposed her proposal. Four of them lost their primary elections that June, and other Reynolds-backed candidates won in that election, and in November, too. The party picked up four seats in the House and two in the Senate. In the latter case, that gave the GOP a supermajority of over two-thirds of seats. The ambitious new laws that followed in the 2023 and 2024 sessions have been remarkable, not just for their scope, but also their sheer number. Tax money pouring into private schools, soon without any income restriction on the families involved, complicated new asset tests for eligibility for food benefits and other assistance, an abortion ban as strict and bereft of meaningful exceptions as almost any in the country, the end of dedicated funding streams that for decades paid for area education agencies to assist schools with special education and programming needs. Government reorganization that concentrates authority in the governor's office, strict limits on new spending by cities and counties, a flat income tax, repeated instances of lawmakers substituting their judgment for that of professionals, librarians, and teachers on what books and lessons to offer students, and doctors on the treatments to pursue for transgender children. Of course, this is far from a comprehensive list. Reynolds' influence was most direct in securing passage of the education savings accounts for private schools, but the large majorities have allowed Republicans to enact policies even over the objections of their peers. Over the 2 years, 12 bills have become, or are on track to become, law despite at least five House Republicans voting against them. Five bills had eight or more GOP no votes. Instead of tackling the difficult undertaking of working on problems that were apparent 2 years ago, worsening water quality, expiring COVID-19 aid, a labor shortage, an uncertain future for ethanol and the crops used to make it, inadequate nursing home care, the Republican agenda delivered some incomplete solutions, ignored many problems altogether, and created some new problems to boot. Instead of pondering how to balance property tax burdens with higher costs for vital local services, the Reynolds legislature just told cities and counties to spend less. Instead of truly regulating damaging farm field runoff and spending big on cleaning public waters, the Reynolds legislature declined even to allow watershed management authority, the symbolic step of adding soil health to their missions, instead of working with public school districts to apply additional resources to help children close COVID-widened learning gaps. legislators started regulating what people can read at school, spent big on handouts to high-income families with children at religious schools, and turned the complex issue of chronic absenteeism into a judicial matter. Rather than do something about Iowa's well-earned reputation as unwelcoming amid a water shortage, the Reynolds legislature slashed child labor restrictions, told police they can start arresting undocumented immigrants, and put all their eggs in their how low can tax rates go basket. Precious few Iowans benefit substantially from all of this. Many other Iowans might see little to no change in their daily lives. But far too many Iowans are left to regard the new policies with suspicion and fear. People who have migrated from other countries or whose appearance suggests they may have done so, people in need of public assistance, people whose choices don't align with the conservative Christian views and now face potential exclusion under a Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Reynolds and the legislature can't claim to be crafting bills to answer Iowa's unique needs. Several of the most objectionable laws clearly came from think tanks' model legislation, copied the actions of other conservative-run states, or both. On some of the most impactful bills, another effect of the Republicans' supermajority is apparent. It's easier to cut deals out of the public eye and then make a show of accepting public comment before pushing through the original plan. This was most evident with the end-of-session income tax bill, which passed both chambers within 2 days of being introduced, hours after an analysis showed it would cost the state treasury $1 billion over 2 years. Even when the public's pushback prompted more reflection, as with remaking special education and diminishing AEAs, the final product hewed closer to where Reynolds started the discussion than to the more modest idea that some House Republicans tried to champion. Iowa should wrap up its experiment with extremism and return to state policy that's more broadly beneficial. This is not just because so many people and their futures are being overlooked under Iowa's current leadership. It's also because many of us, frankly, lack the imagination to know what Reynolds' legislature might try to do next. Who predicted this year's attack on the AEAs? The Kim Reynolds chosen legislature has been bad for Iowa. The next election for governor is not until 2026, but voters this fall can elect a legislature that won't so often bend to her will. Back to you, Nicholas.
Letters to the editor. If legislator pay is inadequate, so are poverty-level wages. State Rep. Phil Thompson of Boone said he is not seeking re-election because he can't afford to serve in the legislature for $25,000, which I am sure is not his family's only income. At the same time, the Republicans moved to ban families whose only income is around $24,000 from receiving supplemental annual income. While I'm underpaid and should get raises, the legislator and governor should show a little concern for those whose income barely enables them to survive. Allowing people on inadequate income to receive supplemental income is not socialism. It is compassionate. It is the kind of income and esteem boosting that a caring legislature should want and guarantee for all Iowa families who live on the same edge of poverty. Signed, Sharon Gee from Des Moines. State decides some children don't deserve help. Never take down a fence until you find out why it was put there in the first place, my late father-in-law would say. I quote him frequently as state government continues cutting programs and services by throwing Iowa's area education agencies, AEAs, into turmoil. That's precisely what lawmakers in our government have done. We ban books, give tax dollars to private schools, and water as conservatives push trained professionals out of state or away from the field of education by hitting our AEAs with a wrecking ball. State government is printing pink slips, deciding which children deserve our help and which ones don't. According to the Des Moines Register, nearly 350 AEA employees have resigned from the state's 9 agencies since the beginning of the school year. Many more will follow, heading to states that value highly trained employees. Years ago, Iowa was shutting down facilities that supported mental health and treated severe disabilities. I was sent out to interview a woman who had just lost her adult son to suicide. He suffered from schizophrenia. Voices in his head were telling him to kill his mother. Fearing he eventually would do it, he stretched his small frame across railroad tracks and soon was killed, severed in two. His mother said mental health programs were limited and would pay for only a few visits to a professional. She did not have the money to pay for more. Tax dollars were saved, she said, but the cost was her son's life. Empathetic state legislators in the past erected facilities and hired professionals to treat our most vulnerable, but those responsibilities were pushed off in large part on law enforcement and the state's jails and prisons. And now the infection spreads to our education system. Signed, Thomas Alex from West Des Moines. Congress should do more to safeguard our elections. As we get closer to November, the 2024 election is shaping up to be one of the most contentious and pivotal elections in generations, if not history. It's alarming that, given the evolving threats to America's election system, members of Congress and the Biden administration have not done more to strengthen the security of our elections. That is particularly true when compared to the resources that were dedicated to security under the Trump administration. In fiscal year 2020, Congress allocated $425 million to bolster our election infrastructure in an election year. To put it into perspective, in an election year, Congress had only just recently allocated $55 million to attempt to safeguard our election in 2024. As a conservative, I'm no fan of Washington's reckless spending spree, but protecting the integrity of our election and the public servants who help administer them is paramount in this critical election year. Too many election official offices nationwide lack the necessities to keep facilities staffed, trained, and secure. In this pivotal election year, we must address these pressing needs and support our critical election infrastructure and security. To do that, our representatives in Washington must work to return funding for election security to the previous levels of commitment we saw under the Trump administration. In the meantime, Iowans should urge their elected officials to help make that happen. Signed, Kelly Koch, Chair, Dallas County Republican Party. State leadership makes Iowa unpalatable for most. One of the most puzzling aspects of living in Iowa is that Governor Kim Reynolds and the Republicans who control the state house actually believe they are making Iowa a better place to live. While that might be true for wealthy few, for most Iowans, the opposite is glaringly obvious. Many of our most gifted young people go off to college and never come back. They just don't see opportunities and an environment they want to live in. Our native-born skilled labor has left in droves. You can't get your driveway paved or your house roofed without using imported workers. When the Iowa Supreme Court gets done with its charade, young women will have to leave the state for needed medical procedures, and young doctors won't want to come to Iowa to start their careers. Iowa nursing homes are already rated last in the nation. Soon, some businesses will only serve heterosexual people. Once number one in the United States, our schools are now ranked mid-pack at best. If you could resurrect the World War II generation who made Iowa the great state it once was, they would be ashamed and angered. They had true principles and lived and voted by them. Signed, Robert Rung from Des Moines. Iowa Republicans clamp down on dissent. I think Rekha Basu speaks for many Iowans in her April 21 column, pointing out the flaws in Governor Kim Reynolds' approach. Iowans want Iowa restored to its position and leadership in the quality of education they receive. Iowans do not want to take away the civil rights of their citizens or to set back women's rights 100 years. And the only way to have true freedom of religion is the separation of church and state. The lopsided dominance in our legislature is now has given Republicans such a power rush that they don't dare break ranks for fear of losing favor with their extremist right leaders who dictate their thinking and their votes. The media is equally fearful of losing the limited access they are allowed to question or report on state house matters, so they only go so far as to report most Republicans support this bill. Some Democrats are critical of certain aspects of it. Signed, Margaret Ennis Ames. Resist the elevation of equity over merit. We were told in an April 18 guest essay that merit, like identity itself, is social construct. We're told further by Robert Leonard that gender and racial quotas on state boards and commissions are the only valid way to objectively measure qualification. A long career in the legal profession of a stable marriage of 4 decades should not be used as an insight into a person's character, but rather a young female rock star attorney should be considered over a man who's been practicing law longer than the rock star has been alive should be appointed. Is that right? We're much better off with a young woman than an experienced man. Mr. Leonard then tells us he's been a reporter for years, which I guess means he knows what merit is. Equity is a warped concept with its roots in those cursed with useless, undeserved white liberal guilt. It must be challenged in every forum where it appeals, or where it appears. Mr. Leonard missed his calling. He should have been an elementary school teacher. Signed, Michael Devine, Fort Dodge. Reynolds should meet with families that she denied grocery aid. Governor Kim Reynolds has rejected $29 million from the federal government for the parents of children who received free school lunches to use for groceries this summer. The reason she gave are more a loyal test for Kim Reynolds than grounded in reality. One reason she gave is that Iowa has a childhood obesity problem. She would have us believe that poor parents spending more at a grocery store will what? Make their children sicker? Is the governor so out of touch that she doesn't know that nutritious food is of 10 more expensive than its high-calorie counterparts? This is like looking at the crack in the foundation of your house and saying that you should not do anything because you haven't addressed the fact that it needs painting. There are children in Iowa that are food insecure, to our collective shame. Reynolds has cited the projected $2.2 million cost in the first year of the program as another reason to reject this $29 million federal dollars coming to our state. With this, she wants us to reject basic arithmetic. This is right out of the authoritarian playbook. See how big a whopper you can get away with. If you buy into a whopper that's $2.2 million for $29 million, is a bad deal. Kim Reynolds knows that you are a loyal follower of hers. And really, who is hurt? None of her donors. It should be noted that children can't vote in Iowa, although they can work in packing plants. Come on, Iowans. Are you unquestionably with Kim Reynolds. Do you believe that restricting food dollars helps nutrition? Do you believe that 29 for 2 is a rotten deal? Or do you believe that more money for the estimated 245,000 children who would benefit is an investment in Iowa's future? And can you do the math on this deal? Every one of us well-fed Iowans should flood the governor's phone line to get her to reconsider. Every donor to her campaign should tell her that they elected her governor, not the person who defines reality. Nebraska's governor changed his mind after talking to parents whose children would benefit. We could at least ask that Reynolds meet with the parents of children who are affected by her rejection of these federal dollars. She can tell them face-to-face that they can't be trusted with an extra $40 per month to make nutritional choices for their own children, and that math, according to Kim Reynolds, is a bunch of bullcrap. Signed, T.C. Loving, Humboldt. A revolution is discipline. Allowing teachers to carry firearms in the classroom will have zero effect in preventing future school shootings, although it may make kids think twice about chewing gum in class. Signed, Theodore Rafe from Des Moines. And lastly, EPA needs to use Big Stick. The Iowa Environmental Council has submitted a Safe Drinking Water Act petition to the EPA, a cry for help for well owners in northeast Iowa drinking unsafe water. In 1988, the driftless counties were just beginning to feel the effects of industrialized agriculture's voracious appetite to feed emerging ethanol and CAFO industries. Corn, bean, and continuous corn practices exploded, but DNR and other Iowa scientists were not yet muzzled. That's when groundwater contamination and land management in the karst area of northeastern Iowa was published. The abstract states, a statistical analysis of existing northeast Iowa water quality data showed that systematic non-point contamination of groundwater quality was occurring in regional carbonate aquifers. Agricultural practices were judged to be the source of the contaminants. Let no one pretend that nitrate contamination of Iowa's karst aquifers was unknown. The cause was unknown. The solutions to the problem were unknown. Statements to the contrary by the government and the industry spokesmen are mendacious. There are dozens of completely on-point Iowa-specific research papers dealing with this issue. Nitrate causes cancer. With a revelation that Iowa is second in the nation in cancers and the only state where the cancer rate is increasing, be a wake-up call to the public? As much as we reject government institutions, is it time for EPA to use its big stick to do nothing and people die? Signed, Steve Vasey from Ames.
Okay, Nicholas, are we going to try to do Dear Abby before the break? Well, yeah, okay. It's time. Okay, we're going to do Dear Abby. Okay. I'm going to read the letter, and Nicholas will read the response. So here we go. Frightened wife is tired of living a lie at home. Dear Abby, I've been deceiving my husband for a couple of months, and I can't figure out how to come clean. I feel like a terrible person. We've been married 17 years, and during the first 4 or 5, we were happy. We don't have many disagreements, but when we do, he always wins. This is because he's intense, intelligent, and very intimidating, so I always back down. I am so uncomfortable with him and careful about what I say that it has started to make me depressed and anxious. I'm in therapy and trying hard to speak up for myself. The deception I speak of is that I have rented an apartment in another town and have lied to him about trips to see my sister, my daughter, and my mother just so I can feel some peace, read a book, knit, and just be. He has no idea because our finances are separate, his choice. I'm afraid to tell my husband. I want to leave him because a few years ago I expressed how unhappy I was and said I didn't recognize this small, scared version of myself. He went from frighteningly furious to crying and begging me to stay. I felt so guilty that I stayed. He knows I'm unhappy. He even knows his quiet, underlying rage scares me. His pitiful begging me to stay makes me feel like a bad person. I feel so much better when I'm away from him, but I'm terrified about how he'll react when I say I want to leave for good. I know that when I do, I gather that the courage, I'd likely lose everything we have together. Please advise me, facing the truth.
Dear Facing, the time to talk to an attorney is now, well in advance of taking any action. Doing so will help you to determine exactly what kind of financial hit you may suffer if you follow through with your plan to leave. Since your finances are separate, it may not be as bad as you fear. Because you are fearful of your safety, you should also contact the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 800-799-7233 or thehotline.org. The folks there can help you to formulate a safe escape plan.
And our next letter. Dear Abby, my significant other loves to play video games. I believe he's become addicted. I don't know how to tell him enough is enough. I'd love to be heard and noticed by him, but he's too infatuated with his video games. I've even participated in his hobby with him. Am I the bad guy for wanting quality time? What can I do? And this is from Losing the Game in Maryland.
Dear Losing, there is nothing wrong with playing video games unless it becomes an obsession. Tell your significant other that if he wants your relationship to continue, he is going to have to devote more time to it. Tell him you no longer feel you are noticed or heard, and that is hurtful. How he reacts will tell you all you need to know about whether your romance can be saved. Here's a reminder that you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. You can listen to podcasts of this and many other IRIS programs at iowaradioreading.org. It's time for a quick break, and we'll return with more articles from the Des Moines Register.